to another episode of Conversations, the show for girls by girls. I'm your host, Sharuk.
And I'm Tamara. Today we're going to talk about racism in Canada. We'll discuss the ins and outs of police brutality and our flawed justice system with Jason Seguia and Yana Mina.
Both guests have experience in advocating for Canada's racial injustices and will be sharing their insight today.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Jason Seguia, pronouns he and him. I'm currently the Equity Commissioner for the University of Ottawa Students Union and spokesperson for the Ottawa Black Diaspora Coalition. Really looking forward for this conversation.
Hi, everyone. My name is Yana Mina. My pronouns are she, her, elle. I'm currently co-president of the Black Student Leaders Association at the University of Ottawa, and I'm really glad that I'm joining this podcast.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. And it's important for us to start each episode with a land acknowledgement to recognize the traditional meeting grounds of Indigenous peoples. Today, I am recording from the traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabe, the Chippewa, and the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat people. And it is now home to many diverse First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people.
I am also recording on the traditional unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe people.
Currently, because of the United States' track record of racial injustices, Canada has been able to get away with portraying itself as a progressive country. And many believe that to be true. Around the same time of the No Peace Until Justice protest of June of 2020, Premier Doug Ford stated that Canada does not have, and I quote, the systemic deep roots of racism that the United States has, a statement he later backtracked after immense backlash. So, how racist is Canada?
If we're talking numbers, for starters, in Toronto, the country's most populated city, Black residents are 20 times more likely to be shot by police, but it doesn't end there. According to the Ontario Human Rights Commission report, it found that they account for 61 of all police encounters that have resulted in death. To put this in a little more perspective, 71% of police encounters result in death, and the Black population in Toronto only amounts for 10% of the population.
The Ottawa Police conducted a study in 2016 that found that Black and Middle Eastern drivers were more often pulled over and arrested than non-BIPOC drivers. The same study found out that those racialized drivers were not likely to have committed a traffic violation in the first place.
Recently, the City of Ottawa has voted to increase police funding, and the Ottawa Diaspora Movement has advocated and pushed forward a notion on social media to call for MPs, city councils to retaliate that. What do police defunding and reallocation of funds actually mean?
I really like this question. Thank you so much for bringing it up, especially in the context of the Ottawa Police Services here. So recently, they increased their budget by about $13 million. In their proposal, they're pitching it saying that this increase of budget would cater towards the changes that the community was looking for, specifically the BIPOC community. Their mission behind it was to advance their initiatives related to equity, diversity, inclusion, once again, emphasizing that this is what the community wanted. But was that actually the case? Is it true that the community actually wanted these changes when they were marching down the streets, such as the Justice for Abdi Khaman Abdi Coalition, calling for a freeze in the police budget? Was this really what the community wanted when folks were doing a full blockade on Laurier and Nichols, calling once again for a freeze in this budget? Where is this truly what the community wanted when folks were saying reallocating those funds into services that would actually better support these communities? We're not asking for a retroactive approach that deals with crime as the main issue or crime as the center, but rather views it as a symptom. And instead, we're asking for a reallocation for these funds in systems that actually need that support, whether that's in education, whether that's in healthcare, especially in the idea that we're in a full pandemic, whether that's in housing and more. We're looking for abolishing systems that actually don't work for us. In fact, they cause us more harm, and recreating systems that actually serve the communities such as our own who are so, so vulnerable. Now, when we get into conversations of what does dissolving full services or abolishing services that are dangerous to us look like, folks get a little afraid. What happens when you need to call someone? I agree with that question, and we want to engage into that type of research. But with that research, we also want to include folks who currently don't feel safe when calling the police. The amount of times I've heard Black folk with testimonies share that I was facing a situation, whether that's a mental health crisis, whether it's a situation with a loved one or family, and I can't call the police, who do I call? That's proof enough that we need to change these systems.
Thank you for sharing that. That is indeed insightful.
And the problem of police brutality is that it does not end in Ontario. Quebec Premier François Legault claimed systemic discrimination is non-existent in Quebec. And regardless of the backlash, unlike Doug Ford, he did not backtrack his statement. Quebec's numbers vary as well. An independent study found that Indigenous and Black people were 4 to 5 times more likely than non-BIPOC people to be stopped by the police. The same study found that Indigenous women were particularly overrepresented. They were 11 times more likely to be stopped, and Middle Eastern people were 4 times more likely to be stopped by the police as well.
The other coast doesn't get much better. Similar to Quebec statistics, in 2016, CBC obtained data from the Edmonton Police in Alberta stating that Aboriginal women were nearly 10 times as likely to be searched by police, Aboriginal people were 6 times more likely than white people to be stopped by Edmonton police, and Black people were almost 5 times as likely as white people to be stopped.
However, regardless of multiple allegations of RCMP and Edmonton Police Services abuses against Indigenous and Black people, Alberta's RCMP Deputy Commissioner Curtis Zablocki denied that there is any systemic racism in policing in Canada.
Not all politicians are open about their disbelief of systemic racism. During the summer, many politicians showed up to support the No Peace Until Justice protests. What are some thoughts on members of Parliament and Justin Trudeau showing up to protests and kneeling and yet not introducing any change in Parliament?
For sure. This is something that to me rendered me really, really frustrated in trying to realize, is this truly an act of performative activism or is this truly blatant ignorance or a combination of both? Let's be honest. The fact of the matter is, everyone, whether it's these politicians, including Justin Trudeau, as well as these organizations who have now reimagined their public image to be centered around creating spaces that exist for Black folk and dismantling systemic racism, have to shape up with what it actually means to dismantle systemic racism. When we're engaging in conversation about systemic racism, we're talking about taking down oppressive approaches, oppressive systems, oppressive policies, which have become norms in our society, so deeply embedded that they become viewed as normal and regular, which is why, as you mentioned before, not only are folks in policing in Alberta claiming that there's no systemic racism in Canada, even here in Ottawa, there are representatives once again saying that there's no issues of systemic racism here in the policing within the city. And it's simply because folks fail to realize that it's become so deeply embedded and has become so embraced as a norm that you're failing to see it. Now, the issue that I'm raising or that I find to be frustrating is that people are doing the work to prove that it is an issue and calling for genuine, genuine change. When I see folk like Justin Trudeau showing up to these marches and kneeling and saying he's for the cause, but then distancing the issue to say that it's in recognizing the issue that exists in the States rather than recognizing the harm that's being caused here in the city of Ottawa, I find that to be disrespectful. I view Justin Trudeau as someone who can make genuine, genuine change, which goes beyond just offering support for Black businesses. It means shaping up what policing looks like within these spaces. It means supporting initiatives that actually transform change so that we're viewed and included in these conversations. He has influence to move forward, as do so many other politicians who are once again signaling that we are moving forward in this cause of recognizing and supporting Black folk, but just not including them in the conversation, and that no longer works.
Thank you. I really appreciate the comment that you made about how there are so many people and organizations that are taking the steps to actually initiating real change for the people, but it's our politicians and people in power that are deflecting racism by only referring to the United States. In turn, this twists things, and that's how a crisis has risen, especially for Canada, and it's an easier way for people of power to neglect critical problems.
When it comes to police shooting, Canada does play innocent. And yes, we rank behind the United States when it comes to numbers murdered by the police. However, our numbers aren't exactly low either. The numbers of citizens murdered by the police are much higher than most other nations, including that of France, Australia, the Netherlands, and Portugal. The call to defund the police both echoes and is demanded in Canada as it is in the United States. The problems of marginalized groups don't end with bad policing. In fact, it extends to incarceration rates as well. According to a 2019 government survey, Indigenous and Black individuals appear to be overrepresented in Canada's prison.
The Black population in Canada amounts to 3%. However, they make up almost 10% of the federal prison population. Similarly, Indigenous people are 5% of Canada's population, and yet they're 30% of federal prisoners. And under previous Prime Minister Stephen Harper, mandatory minimums were introduced. which limits the power of a judge to shorten jail time on a variety of criminal charges.
It is important to note that system reform is easier said than done, mainly because the other problems that litter Canada's justice system. And yet system reform was promised by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau during his election campaign in 2016. However, this promise was later unattended to.
During Trudeau's first year in office, Canada's crime rates hit a 45-year low. One might think that this reflects low incarceration rates, and yet prison rates reached an all-time record, paradoxically.
The overrepresentation of racialized groups in the prisons of Canada represents the racial discrimination and over-policing of Black and Indigenous people all throughout Canada. And study after study further explain and prove this phenomenon.
Black men have traditionally been overwhelmingly indicted for minor marijuana offenses. Time and time again, studies prove that visible minorities are more likely to be carded, meaning stopped by the police while simply walking the streets and asked to show ID, despite not being suspected of a crime or showing suspicion.
When hearing these statistics, Canadians don't realize that this isn't something that's far-fetched. Sometimes this happens in your own backyard. More recently, the University of Ottawa has been in the news for many reasons, one of them being Races Act on campus and the carding incidents of multiple students.
Just to speak on that, so a lot of not only carding incidents, but other microaggressive forms of racism have been felt and seen and experienced by us racialized students at University of Ottawa. So the carding incident that happened June 2019 was truly, like my colleague has mentioned, it's more of a symptom of like the greater institutional racism that resides at University of Ottawa and a lot of universities. We are not the first, we are not the last, unfortunately. And a bigger issue as to why this is persistent, whether it be carding incidents, whether it be professors upholding or justifying why they should use the N-word, whether it even be the university trying to take on solutions, quote unquote, that don't involve Black, Indigenous, or just racialized voices at the table. It's just this overall disregard and this sort of mask of Canada being superior to the States or being without systemic racism or being committed, quote unquote, to fighting systemic racism while not actually addressing it with the people it affects most. So a lot of these incidences has fortunately gotten the BIPOC community in Ottawa at large to mobilize and fight against this and become a resource, not only for education, but for awareness and speaking up through protests, through sit-ins, which one did happen on campus back in December. And me and Jason were in attendance of that, whether it be the coalitions and the organizations and the groups that have formed as a result of what has happened. And it's just a way for us to be more proactive. And more than ever, I think 2020 has opened a lot of people's eyes to, again, not just overall systemic racism, but racism in every environment that we frequent. And even though we're not exactly physically on campus, that racism still permeates every part of our lives as University of Ottawa students.
I want to talk about this carding and the sit-in, but first, for the carding incident, do you think it's a matter of like reinforcing? Because they did implement a rule against the security and like not carding BIPOC people. However, do you think it's a matter of enforcing that or just retraining security? How do you think that can be like tackled from the university's part?
Truthfully, when everything first occurred and I was not as aware as most students of like the policies for our quote unquote protection services, I thought maybe a retraining was necessary or even like policy reform. And that's just like based on my conditioning and my experience in my program at University of Ottawa. But I realize you need to, much like defunding the police, much like even abolishing and appalling the whole system, I think that's more necessary because you can provide the training and you can wrap up this sort of system in a bow, but on the inside, it's still so tainted by white supremacy and by unconscious bias. So there needs to be a way that students are the ones that are even providing the safety, for example, or it's just these funds are reallocated to mental health services and other resources that can better the student's safety and wellness and well-being on campus. I think that the training and especially even the policies and everything, there's a certain lack of transparency that our school upholds. And so it's so hard to even track or really detect the difference between how they were before and when these cardiac incidents have occurred versus after a retraining and these solutions are applied. There's no accountability to even ensure the implementation, and there's no accountability to say that there's actually a difference that's been made. So I think there needs to be a complete removal of the service entirely.
Just building off on that, I love that it was mentioned that, yes, the University of Ottawa had introduced new measures to address those carding incidences. Shouldn't be that band-aid solution that deals with it. But what needs to be recognized is literally 2 weeks after this new list of policy, which said that students have the ability and the right to say, no, I don't want to give you my identification. I'm not going to provide it to you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That there was another carding incident that had affected another University of Ottawa student. The reason why I bring up this problem is that this is also repeating as a cycle. Even now in February 2021, on the 1st of February, as we're entering Black History Month, the University of Ottawa had introduced a new amount of different measures that they're going to be introducing to address systemic racism here on campus. Some of them reflected some of the calls to actions we'd included in previous campaigns, but this didn't take away from the fact that following this announcement of new procedures, there was yet once again another incident of racism here on our campus. A biology professor had sent out to all of his students who had finished his course last year a letter, once again distancing issues of racism to the United States, fending for his right in terms of academic probation to use the N-word and other harmful messaging that once again went to further traumatize Black students. At this point in time, we're pushing once again for further calls to action that truly dismantle these issues, that reframe our understanding of what is campus security, which, as Yenamina says, may not look like actually having campus cops on campus. And instead, it looks like reinvesting these funds that are usually allocated to these services to other supports, whether that's mental health, whether that's sexual violence and prevention, whether that's other forms of support as well. So it's shifting away funding to those forms of supports rather than to different supports that have continued to cause us harm in the past.
Thank you. And I know Yanina mentioned the December you had the protest sit-in at the UOttawa admin building. Regarding that, what were some barriers that you, aside from COVID, obviously, what were some barriers that you thought maybe like admin was holding back, they were refusing, or like, were there any obstacles that you thought were coming from the admin side as opposed to like the unprecedented times of COVID?
I think just the overall disregard and the ignorance surrounding the purpose of the sit-in and what we were calling for. I think there was, in the first place, the two white supremacists that came and infiltrated the sit-in that put all of us at risk. There was no follow-up from the university. There was no sort of check-in for our well-being or safety at that time, in addition to the fact there was no follow-up from the university until the very last minute, the 11th hour, so to speak, when we decided to stop the sit-in because of COVID restrictions and because of just our overall mental, physical health. And then they decided to propose a meeting on their own terms while we've been asking for a meeting up to that point for about 120 plus hours. That was the barrier overall, just like the purposeful ignorance of what we're asking for and of avoiding the fact that we need to have these conversations and these consultations with BIPOC students. And it's so sad that we had to go through all of that. It was empowering in that, you know, mobilized a lot of folk to come out and speak out and spread awareness. But it was so unfortunate that with all of that that happened, that the university still chose willful ignorance as a response. So I think that was a major barrier. And definitely at times, just keeping up morale and feelings of just like helplessness or hopelessness and trying to keep that momentum alive, which I really thank a lot of the people that came out and helped out and were a resource, because we even had like peer support there. We had some of the sports teams come out and we did yoga exercises together. There was a lot of moments of even just celebration of the sort of empowerment that we're sharing in that space and the collective effervescence of just student activism. But yeah, these were still barriers.
That's amazing. I just wanted to add, like, on the topic of morale, thinking about it, most of the people that are involved in these sit-ins and that are organizing these collective actions, they're students and everyone is so young. And unfortunately, systemic racism is something that you've had to face inevitably, like, it's still not fair. I hope you all know that your work goes extremely appreciated within the communities. And like, I hope that there are ways that you are able to stay grounded and to take care of yourself, because it's not an easy process. People might think, oh, like, why are they protesting? Like, don't they have school and all these things? But the fact that this is going to be a fact of life, and that you guys are prioritizing the time to do this on behalf of other students and for the Black community as well, is amazing. I know you mentioned that there was like a lot of the congregation of sports teams and like so many students having all the yoga sessions and stuff. Like, are there any tips or ways that have kept your wellness in check during these times? Because I can't even imagine how taxing this kind of work is.
Yeah, definitely. It takes a lot of taking those breaks and taking that step back, because we're on our phones a lot, you know what I mean, generally, and especially in this pandemic, but especially when you are a student activist, and a lot of our mobilization happens online, happens through social media. So I think, as for me, and I see a lot of my colleagues, just taking a step back from our phones and like engaging in real life for a second, being present, other wellness practices, whether it be religious, whether it be even just being mindful of eating and sleeping and resting when we feel tired, because a lot of times we are put in these positions, and we put ourselves in these positions to be community builders and do that outreach and do that work, but we don't address our own burnout because it's just go, 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 and we want to help each other and uplift each other as much as we can, but we neglect ourselves. So I think it's especially all of us who are involved in such a way, when we talk to each other and say, hey, are you okay? Like, do you need to take a step back? Can I help you with something? Those type of things are very much helpful in terms of acknowledging our wellness or lack thereof. So yeah, I think that's another way. And you actually mentioned something that I forgot to mention, that was a major barrier at the time and still is that we are still students. Aside from everything else, we're students. And often because of the work that we have to do, it impedes on our performance academically. It impedes on the work that we have to do. Like, this didn't happen during exams. It happened during where a lot of us had jobs, classes. And in addition to this, it happened when a lot of us were taking courses from those professors who, again, are trying to justify using the N-word. We are, no matter where we are, we're in this constant fight of for our own humanity, for our own rights, and you can't run from it. And it takes away from all the other ways we want to be productive or need to be productive. So that's definitely a huge barrier too.
And right before we move on to the next section, I just want to sort of jump back to the sit-in. For those who haven't heard of it before or just weren't aware, can you quickly just go over how you started it, what like triggered it, aside from like the constant buildup, what was sort of like the constant push and like why you did it, and sort of the list of demands? Because I know that was one of the reasons you held out for so long, is because you wanted admin to sort of listen, which they should. So just go over it really quick for those who haven't heard of it.
Yeah, so there were, as we know, various egregious events that happened at University of Ottawa from even like 2017, but really 2019, when a lot of us got involved and created calls to actions to address all of those issues. And so previously, BSLA and a couple of other BIPOC students were sitting on the President's Advisory Committee to address systemic racism, which happened as a reactive solution to the carding incident in 2019. And while on that committee, none of what was asked by BIPOC students was implemented. I think it was probably only one thing where we were asking for a former member of BSLA. She was asking to have a policy in the syllabi for all faculties where it addresses anti-Blackness and anti-racism and pointing out the resources that we have on campus, the quote-unquote resources, like the Human Rights Office. But aside from that, there was any other of those calls to actions that were implemented. And then at the very last meeting without a committee, we had asked that this be a committee of action rather than conversation or performative action, which is a lot of the time what these committees, working groups, panels, whatever you want to call it, is what it becomes. And then without our consultation and without considering BIPOC voices or those former members, an action committee on anti-racism and inclusion was created by the president. Again, very reactive. And this committee not only did not consider us, but the ways in which it decided to implement it, or it was those solutions that they had that they wanted to put in place, again, did not involve BIPOC voices. And so to call that out, the various events leading up to just the overall disapproval by BIPOC students, we decided to formulate what is known as U-Racism on social media. And it's just a collective, but a community of BIPOC students from various other organizations and affiliations, just letting the university know that this is not okay. And you think that you've created a solution, but you have not. And we actually reject the invitation to participate in such committee. And so we had various demands, the first being having the dissolution of the action committee, and then also introduction of the anti-racism office, which is autonomous and independent of the university, so that we can ensure complete transparency and accountability, hiring a BIPOC anti-racism officer, also just introduction of a university-wide anti-racism policy, because it was non-existent, and just actually having something in systemically ingrained to ensure that. Also revealing the full budget of protection services, because again, complete lack of transparency there. And there's been talks of the protection services having their budget increase. Meanwhile, we severely lack funding and resources for mental health on campus, especially for BIPOC students. And yeah, so we just had various calls to just improve and ensure BIPOC student safety and wellness on campus. It is really, we're not asking for the moon, as some would say, but after talks of this and releasing this call to action, we decided to have a protest, or what we started out as a protest, and until we got a response from admin and mainly President Jacques Fremont and the Provost Jill Scott, and we heard nothing from them, and we decided to make it a sit-in, and then it lasted as long as it did, about 120 plus hours, so that was over a course of almost 6 days, and we had many professors, student athletes, Ottawa Gatineau community members, other organizations, coalitions, collectives, organizations reach out to us to donate, whether it be food, sleeping bags, funding, which we did give to Hit the Streets, so another organization here in Ottawa, because we didn't want to collect funding for this. That wasn't the main goal, but we definitely duly appreciated and benefited from the food and the blankets and other resources that people provided for us so that we can be as comfortable as possible sleeping on the university floor. So yeah, that, and it turned into this sit-in over time, and then it turned into an even bigger movement on social media, on Instagram, on Twitter. And we had many news sources come and talk to us and interview us on what was going on and what had happened previously at the University of Ottawa. Yeah, it was just, it blew up into something bigger than we thought it would be, and with good reason too, because for a lot of people who are outside of the realms of student activists, they were not aware of any of the issues at University of Ottawa at all. They probably would think or say the same thing, where the systemic racism doesn't exist here or in Canada. So we really brought that awareness and had a lot of support and outpouring from the community.
Thank you. And this just proves that Black people in Canada are discriminated against, whether it's across the country, in your city, in your neighborhood, even like in provinces, just disproportionately discriminated against.
And even in academic institutions, it's ridiculous. But moving on to our next topic, despite the evident and blatant racism that is spread throughout Canada's institutions, many still refuse to see it for what it is. A poll done for Global News found that 40% of Canadians believe that racism is an American issue. However, nearly 1 in 3 Canadians say that they have personally experienced racism in the past year. Ironically, within the same sample of Canadians questioned, 6 in 10, that's 60%, believed in the presence of systemic racism in Canada.
And expanding onto that, about what we talked earlier, the results of the poll stated that half of Canadian populations, 50%, found that they believe there to be systemic racism in the RCMP. Out of the same group, 65% believe that there's also systemic racism in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. Similarly, in Quebec and the Atlantic provinces, just over 50% think systemic racism still exists in Canada.
And in the era of COVID, Canadians were also asked if they believe there's to be racism within health services, to which many disagreed.
Recently, Toronto Public Health proved that to be false. They voted to acknowledge anti-Black bias as a public health issue, and evidence gathered has demonstrated that COVID-19 has impacted Black populations overwhelmingly.
A CBC poll reflected that racial inequality was more likely to be perceived by Canadians as people's attitudes and behavior, not a systemic phenomenon rooted in Canadian institutions. And two-thirds of respondents said that there are the same chances for BIPOC people to excel in life.
A similar study found that between 2016 and 2019, the number of people who became more aware of the presence of racism in Canada and in Canadian institutions almost doubled. And many of those sample participants stated that their awareness came mainly from social media.
So, speaking on social media, what are your thoughts and the experiences on the effectiveness of social media and infographics specifically in the fight against racism?
For sure. So currently, we can't go through with this work without acknowledging that we are in a full pandemic and we're reaching that full year mark where our idea of regular life, where there is so much opportunity for physical interaction, public conversations, and more to take place, has been halted and we've moved into a space which is almost entirely virtual. This, at a point in time, specifically for the student movement, has posed its own barriers in general when it comes to our approaches with disseminating information related to the work that we're doing. In the past, many ways that you could raise awareness to these type of issues would be through canvassing, whether that's tabling throughout campus in spaces where students are in those spaces and sharing that information in those type of avenues. However, now that's no longer available. So with that in mind, social media has become one of the major ways that we can get folk involved, that we can share information around our own experiences, and we can move forward with our advancement. But it goes beyond that. Even with our work, one of the most important aspects of it is ensuring that that consultation is kept core with everything that we do. Because to be honest, if our work does not reflect the community that we're aiming to represent, then our work no longer makes sense. Therefore, through social media, it opens so many different avenues, whether to the launch of our recent feedback form, which allows space for folk to provide their ideas, concepts, and what they'd like to see next with You Racism, or general different initiatives that, once again, are being shared through social media. It's through these different mediums, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, that this information is being disseminated. But this is not only proven to be effective with our own movement, it's been proven to be effective with so many other movements, whether we're talking about work that's being done by folks who are part of the African diaspora, specifically raising awareness for the Red Pearl movement, which was speaking on issues that were taking place in Uganda. So recently, Uganda found itself in a full lockout during its elections, and young people were able to raise awareness about these issues globally, once again, through sharing information through social media. Social media proves to be the future, and it serves to be a great, great supplement to the work that's being done. Now, I raise the word supplement really, really, really for a specific reason, because it's supposed to add on to the work. If folk find themselves completely limiting all of their activism, and I'm speaking specifically to those who are serving as allies, to be entirely social media based, especially if it's motivated for the wrong reasons, that's not the work that we're looking for. This should serve as a supplement to the other work that you're doing, including educating yourself on these important issues.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the examples you gave as well, because I did not know about how it extends past just the protests, sharing those news or sharing petitions and stuff. I didn't know it went as far as tipping elections and stuff. That's really insightful. A lot of people debate now performative activism versus showing actual change. So what are some tangible steps people should be taking towards combating racism in Canada?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, part of the battle is acknowledging the blatant existence of systemic racism here in Canada. Part of the battle that we've been finding not only in our own movement here at the University of Ottawa, but in general when raising issues in regards to the city of Ottawa, is the fact that people, quite frankly, don't believe that systemic racism is an issue here. But it goes beyond that. After we've done that work of acknowledging and proving that it exists, folks have also been doing the action of supporting the communities who are directly affected. If you're engaging in this work specifically in activism without consulting the groups that you're dealing with or you're working with, then your work can not only become violent and harmful for them, but it will take away from the work that other people who are actively doing it were a part of that community as well. Beyond that, groups like the Ottawa Black Diaspora Coalition have been advocating and pushing for reallocations of funds in various different services putting an emphasis on community supports like housing, education, and mental health supports. And it's proven to be successful. Even in various other cities and communities, including Toronto, folks are taking different approaches where now, as an example, in Toronto, there was a recent push to now send mental health professionals instead of actual uniformed police in dealing with situations that involve mental health crises. So different approaches are being introduced by different groups all across. So whether it's from reallocating funds to better support our communities, whether it's from abolishing systems that are no longer serving us, nor have they ever been serving us, as well as doing that important work of supporting folks who are directly being harmed by these issues, this has been the support and the success of many different activists all across Canada at this current time.
Thank you so much. While Canada may be good at concealing it, racism is very much an issue in Canadian institutions and Canada as a whole. Deflecting the blame by pointing to the United States does not take away from our problem. In fact, it makes it much worse.
Alrighty, thank you so much for tuning into this episode, and thank you to our guests for giving the time and energy to be part of our very first episode, and I hope all of the listeners found it enlightening and hopefully learned something. And make sure to stay updated on our Instagram and catch us on the next episode of Conversations.
Jingle created by Dane Bjornson.